Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Mary-Anne Stone and Maureen Rutt. And I've got two really interesting books today.
Yeah.
A first novel from Dunedin writer Breton Dukes, which has already been called by Steve Brawnius, of course, the best fiction book so far of the year. And I'd have to agree. I won't tell you about it now because you've got to listen.
But it's queasy-making.
Oh, queasy-making
read. But terrific in the best possible way.
Yeah, edge of your seat stuff.
Yeah.
And then I'm talking with renowned historian Paul Moon about a really intriguing book called The Art of Colonization, where he takes particular works of art and has a good look at them and talks about their background and how, you know, what's behind them, why were they painted, who were they painted for, and how they've affected our view of Aotearoa.
Yeah, no, I listened into that and both those interviews, both fabulous, and I guess that kind of mashup of art history and art politics, you know. My book lightens the tone considerably for the episode. Stay listening for the final interview with Stephanie Holmes, where we talk about her 55th novel called A Grave Mistake. Now, Stephanie is a self-described author of smutty vampire fiction. She's an advocate for romantic-y novels of all kinds, and she's an absolute delight living her best life, and it's well worth a listen.
Well, I can't think of any better antidote
to the seriousness of the world.
To the seriousness of the world. Aotearoa writer Breton Dukes has had something of a dream run with the launch of his first novel, Party Boy. There was a week of reviews, background features, opinions, all from friends and possibly people he didn't know on Newsroom in the reading room part of that. And that really has alerted the reading public of New Zealand to the features of this book. Breton has previously written three short story collections, and he has received the Creative New Zealand Louis Johnson New Writer's Bursary. Breton, this book had me in a fine state of agitation right from the beginning, and because Marco, the main character, is on the edge of an abyss for most of the book. You don't let us off very often, but we'll go into that as we talk. Can you introduce us to Marco, please?
Yeah, so when we meet Marco, he's right at the beginning of what will turn into a very stressful shift at a bar here in Dunedin. And as, I guess, the pressure mounts on him, as the orders come in and he's not able to keep up with them, he gets sort of driven into this sort of difficult mental state where he begins remembering some of the other moments in his life, I guess, where he's been out of control. What that scene did for me set up really the rest of the novel, because all of the things that come after that first scene in the restaurant, I then am able to play with through the rest of the novel. The main thing, I guess, being the final scene, his final 50th birthday scene, which is really the end of the book, where we get an opportunity to see if Marco will finally totally crack or whether he will pull through.
Yeah. And so to sustain that degree of anxiety in your readers, what are the things that you need to do? Do you need to read it out loud as you're writing it, just to make sure that it's paced properly?
Well, one of the things that was useful in keeping the tension high was the flashbacks to when he was 8 years old, and the other one is when he's about 19. And because I've got a background in short stories, I was able to turn those into sort of short story type pieces and continue the tension through them. What I wanted in the novel was there to be almost no soft parts, no gentle areas. I think the scenes where he's with his children are a bit slower and a bit easier for the reader to have a bit of space, and I did that intentionally because in some of the earlier drafts it was just all tension all the way through, and a writer friend suggested that I add that domestic stuff in order to soften the tension, and it also lets us see a different side, a sort of gentler, more human side of Marco, so that was useful. In terms of how I did it, I think I always try and write with really high stakes. I'm not really interested in any writing where there's not a lot at stake. It might just be what's at stake is cooking the arancini properly or getting the orders out. It's not necessarily life and death, but I think what I want to do is put my characters under terrible pressure and see what happens after that. So it's almost a natural instinct in me as a writer is to write with menace and tension. And I have to remind myself sometimes to slow down.
Yeah, it was a relief from time to time. I started reading your book as I was, you know, lying in bed, which is when I often read fiction. And then I realised that I just couldn't do that because there was no way I could turn my brain off after I was trying to read up to a point that I could leave Marco and not concern myself with him, and that happened. So that's a real mark of your writing, isn't it? Let's talk about why Marco is in this state, because you say he goes back to, obviously, to times in his life. And this book really sprang, I think, from real work. You're doing the real work, but incidents in real life, the bullying, the sexual abuse at Otago Boys High School, which is, you know, has happened in most single-sex boys' schools throughout New Zealand.
The book did spring in part from that research. More than anything, what I got from those interviews I did with old boys, the Otago Boys, was sort of the mood and the atmosphere of that time in New Zealand as a male, and maybe in the South Island, or maybe as someone at an all-boys school. I think that was what was most useful. I didn't really take any of the stories I heard, many of which were harrowing. I didn't really use those stories directly. It was more the emotions that I was hearing from the old boys, the language they were using, and a lot more of it is my own experience of growing up in Dunedin in the 1980s. I suppose what I wanted to do was to have a very condensed period of time. It was about 3 weeks the whole novel takes place. And for that three-week period to be important for Marco to begin to realise that he wasn't who he thought he was. He wasn't a bad person. It's a three-week period where some of the confusion, not all of it, but where some of the confusion for Marco about who he is and what he's done begins to lift a bit, and he begins to see himself in a slightly different way. It's not a great revelation. It's just a lightening of the atmosphere for Marco. And I felt that if I did the backstory well on Marco, so for the reader to arrive at that party scene knowing a lot about Marco and having maybe conflicting emotions about him, I felt that if I could get him and the reader to that place before the party, then anything could happen. That was my feeling going into the party scene. I didn't know how it was going to end. I didn't know what was going to happen in the party. But I built up this tremendous feeling in myself for who Marco was. So it was very exciting and daunting writing that party scene. It took me a long time to get that first doorbell ringing. I avoided it, but I was terrified. I didn't know if I could do it. But I think I had so much information in me about place, from the interviews, from my own experience as a father, that when the first doorbell did ring, I was really ready and I was absolutely in the zone. And it took me quite a while to write it, but not as long as I expected. And the things that happened at the party surprised me constantly. I wasn't sure. It was sort of moment by moment. Oh, okay, those guys are going to turn up. They've been at the Spates Ale House. They come charging in around the side of the house. And then the sort of, I guess, the climax where he sort of finally is able to tell people about what he did and to admit to that. I didn't know that was coming. I knew something big had to happen, but I didn't know what it was. It was very exciting.
It must have been. It's like the dam bursting, isn't it? You must, when you say that you didn't know exactly how and when it would happen, I can imagine you just... Were you able to actually leave your seat, leave the keyboard?
Good. It was very tiring. I was really full of emotion. And I thinking about it now, I feel emotional because I put everything that I could possibly sort of gather into that final scene. It was like I was inhabited by something, and it was just pouring out. I was crying when I was writing it. I was listening to the most outrageous music, like Celine Dion, because I wanted to experience pure emotion. I wanted to experience love, lightness, because there's so much darkness gushing through. And I think that's why that last scene works in a way. It's both light and dark. There's horror and there's love in it. And I think that's it was a very transcendental experience, writing that party scene.
Well, I think the reading experience is similar. You describe things so thoroughly. I mean, where people are exactly, you know, you use real locations on the whole.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can play with those, but you know that people reading it, some of the people who live in Dunedin will know exactly what the traffic is doing, where those intersections are. So, and the food, I mean, I know you've worked in kitchens, you've worked as a chef, but the whole the whole descriptions, you know, as that party scene is evolving, you're also playing with our senses of taste and smell, aren't you?
What I'm trying to do is provide no opportunity for the reader to get away from the text. I need it to be as convincing and as alive as I can possibly make it. So the reader's mind is just as focused as my mind is as the writer. I don't want the reader to feel at any point that they can leave. But they have to stay there. And if I'm going to be writing about pomegranate seeds or the way I've cut the mint for the salad or the sound of the meat on the barbecue, the act that I'm trying to achieve is to hold the reader under the story so that there's nowhere they can go. They have to feel it the way that I'm feeling. And I think that's where, when you're writing well, that's what you can achieve. There's got to be no soft part.
No. I'll tell you one of the parts that I found as grueling as any of the parts was when Marco is 8 and he's sent out for the day by his mother, who's, you know, waxes hot and cold, but mostly cold. She orders him out of the house and he has to spend this time mooching around, kicking stones, picking up sticks, looking at insects.
Yeah.
And you know something is, you know, he's at risk, he's at peril, even though he's just sort of, as I say, mooching about on a day.
Yeah.
And something does happen to him. So, you know, that in itself to me was as grueling as the lead up to the party because of that knowledge that.
For me, backstory is always important in stories. It's just a nice way for the reader to get to know more about the main character, say, so that when something major happens, the reader has some feeling about the choices that a character should or shouldn't make. It sort of comes down to motivation. And what was very successful early on was the sense that I could have Marco going into therapy and telling his therapist about these terrible things that had happened, but doing it in real time. So it's not Marco sitting there saying, oh, when I was 8, I had some trouble with someone with a dog. I was scared. I was lonely. That's okay, but I think what I found was going to work better was if I just shunt the whole story back to 1981 and to focus on, like any good writing, like I was talking about, focus on the details, slowly build it up sentence by sentence. That was very effective, and I figured that out quite early on, that I could use therapy as a way to tell backstory. And I copied that off my favourite TV series, The Sopranos, where they did that a lot, especially early on. Tony would be talking to his therapist, Dr. Melfi, and then the viewer would be taken back in time to see how the actual event played out. So that was sort of how I worked my way into those. Initially, it was just the two shifts into the past, and then I added that third one where he's in the seventh form common room. That came in a bit later.
Mm.
But,
Breton, just to finish, have you been relieved, pleased, surprised that people are reacting to the book in the way that you hoped they would?
Yeah, I've been pleased. It's noticeable how much more attention I'm getting for writing a novel compared to collections of short stories, which is, I feel a bit sad in a way because short stories are just as valid as novels. But, I'm pleasantly surprised at the amount of interest.
Great. Thank you for doing it. It's been one of my best reads of the year, I have to say.
Thank you.
I absolutely encourage people to go out and find a copy of Party Boy by Breton Dukes, published by Te Heringa Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Professor Paul Moon has written over 40 books on New Zealand, history, art, you name it. He's been a finalist in two international history awards. His biography of photographer Anne's Westra was critically acclaimed, and this latest book, The Art of Colonisation, Images of Europe's Encounters with New Zealand, shows how imperial art was another form of claiming the territory and encouraging immigration. Paul, welcome to Bookends.
And thank you very much.
I'm going to ask a very broad question to start off with, and that's, what can and does the art of the period tell us?
Well, it tells us that there's no single view about how Europeans saw colonisation in that period of 200 or 300 years. I think a lot of people think nowadays that European colonisers simply spied a territory and they thought, great, we're going to occupy it, conquer it and control it. What you see here is just a huge range of views, a huge range of different types of understanding of what New Zealand was.
The way you've structured the book is really interesting. I really like your chapter headings. I think it looks like you've had a bit of fun with some of those. But you've picked out individual, you know, obviously you've started with an introduction to the whole book and setting out your thoughts on it. But then you've picked out individual paintings and gone, you know, more thoroughly into them and the artist and what was going on at the time. So yeah, I'm just interested in whether, you know, your thoughts on how you went about doing that.
Well, I was very clear from the outset. I didn't want to do a sort of greatest hits. I didn't want the great paintings of New Zealand in the colonial period. And a lot of those have been discussed, and they don't necessarily give that broad spectrum of what different people were doing when they came here. So some of the pieces are quite unusual. There's one artist, for example, who, as far as we know, there's only one painting of his that survived, and that's in the book. So some of them are quite rare, and a lot of the artists are unknown. And it has to be said, a lot of the art is what we'd say of a mediocre quality. It's not, you know, the greatest artworks you'll come across. But that really was the point. I wasn't too concerned about having only the famous pieces, but really the pieces that explain what individuals were seeing, how they saw it, and what they prioritised. So it's a very sort of diverse range of pieces that were included.
Yes, I think that's what surprised me, because I imagined that I was going to be looking at a lot of images, and I wasn't, and that proved to be a very good thing as far as I was concerned, because it did enable you to really not make broad sweeping statements necessarily about the period, but really hone in on what was going on in that particular place and time.
Yeah.
When did you, or maybe you always had this interest in looking at art as well as the documents, because, you know, I think you make a statement about, you know, the difference between an historian having to stick to the facts and an artist being able to do completely different things.
Well, very much so. One of the, it's not a problem really, but one of the features of history is that you're governed in this period by documents. And every document, this is a rule generally in life, every document you read has a motive behind it. And so historians not only read documents, but try to discern what are those motives. And that leads you in certain directions. And one of the things about art, of course, is a whole different set of motives. These aren't officials, generally. They're not people involved in the machinery of colonisation. They're visitors, they're travellers, sometimes missionaries, all sorts of people from a diverse background. And so you're dealing all of a sudden with a new set of motives, and that gives you a completely new set of insights. So my interest in art has always been there, and I suppose it's, this now is the opportunity to do something about it.
Yes, I guess you probably looked, when you were doing all your individual books, you would have been looking at the art that surrounded that to inform you.
Very much so. That's certainly the case. And in fact, I probably started this book 10 or 12 years ago, but because of other projects and so forth, there was always something that was just bubbling away in the background. And so fortunately, I had some time and I was able to finish it. But it's something that's accumulated over well over a decade. As you do research, you know, you come across these odd images, and a lot of them have never been published before. And you think, oh, that explains so much. If only I could, you know, somehow put this in a book. And this is really the result of that thinking.
Who was the art generally for? What were the painters? I mean, you know, I'm asking you to generalise here, but...
I mean, one of them is that obviously people wanted to sell images, but that's really surprising in New Zealand's case, how few of the artists actually painted to sell these images. One of the motives was to record things, much in the way that we pull our phones out now. You know, why do we do that? We do it because we want to have a record of something we think is significant or something different or something that we might want to look at again. So those sorts of motives are quite prominent. People, in some cases, some of the works in this book, they simply produced for their own private records. In other cases, they produced as propaganda works, and you see this in some of the art to do with missionaries. And so these were pieces of art they hoped would be displayed in the headquarters of missionary organisations in London, and that was the case in a few instances. The problem is, of course, that after a couple of generations, you know, that painting's been on the wall and no one remembers who it is. So they've always seen it. They don't know who the characters are in the work. So there's a lot of detective work involved in some of these paintings to work out who actually features in them. So people produce them for a variety of motives.
Yes, I was interested in the fact that, you know, a number of the images were painted to... you know, so that people in Britain, on the whole, could see not exactly a rosy view of New Zealand, but, you know, a view of New Zealand that would encourage them to come out. So, you know, you pulled back any of the sort of savage... parts of the landscape and the people, so it looked more, you know, soft and gentle and more European than it actually was.
Yeah, it's very much the case. And the funny thing about the savage and barbarian representation is that does appear, but it appears at the very end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, when the European population is something like 95% of the population of the country. And that's when artists start to get even more distance from reality and they start to portray the indigenous population often in quite a negative light. That wasn't so much the case early on in the colonisation process. And, of course, you know, again, it comes down to motive. What are you trying to do with the audience? I mean, there's one extreme example of motive I've included there, but of a family that's about to emigrate from Britain to New Zealand, and it's a family portrait taken in the Highlands of Scotland. And it was all made up. The family's actually from London. they were put in this background, and there's a castle in the background, and the family like to claim, well, that's our family castle. It wasn't true. But the reason they did this was a piece of personal propaganda. They could then hang this up in their house in New Zealand and say, well, we come from Scottish nobility. So, you know, you could recreate yourselves. You could almost forge a new identity through art.
Well, we'd all be tempted to do that when we got here. talk ourselves
up. Pre-internet, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Now, obviously, the bulk of these images were done by Europeans, but there is one fascinating one done by Tupaia. And that, you know, the story behind that is interesting.
It is, and that's probably the only piece of Indigenous art we've got in the conventional sense or Western sense of art from the 18th century. The only piece of art done by an Indigenous person on, you know, using paper and pen and ink. So it's really special, and it's showing a moment of exchange. And it's not a great piece of art, but it's unique, and just as one of those examples of cross-cultural art, that here's someone who's Indigenous, who's travelling with Cook on the exploration of parts of the South Pacific, and obviously is taught a bit about art and very quickly picks it up and produces a painting. And so this is the person, if you like, being colonised, doing a rendition of aspects of colonisation on paper. It's absolutely unique, and I think it's a very special piece.
Yes, his rendition of a crayfish is really good.
Yeah, and bear in mind, this is someone for whom, a year or two earlier, perhaps there was no concept of painting like this, none at all. So he's picked up very quick, and of course he picked up English very quickly as well.
Mm. And he would have been watching people like Banks, and who was the artist on board at that stage?
Well, there were quite a few amateurs and professionals. And the other thing too, of course, is that when some of these images were sent back to Britain from the crew of the Endeavour, other artists then thought, this looks interesting, and they produced their own works. People who had never been to New Zealand started to produce paintings about the country. And you can tell they're very sort of fictionalised versions. There's one painting there of an arrival of a missionary's wife in Taranaki. And if you look at the images of those Māori on shore, they actually look Pākehā. They've got white skin. They almost look like they've got Greek robes on. And so it's a sort of stylized version of what an Indigenous noble savage is. And it's a surreal painting in a way, not in the sense of surreal art, but surreal in the sense that it suspends our version of normality, and it comes up with this highly fictional vision of what missionary activity is like. Mm.
One of the other ones I was going to bring up with you is Augustus Earle's painting of the distant view of the Bay of Islands, because he was a well-regarded artist. And I'm intrigued that he's standing with a Māori who they're walking towards the Bay of Islands. You can explain all the other things about it. But he's looking out on land that looks as though it's all been cultivated. There's not really, it doesn't look as though there's heavy bush there, but there must have been at that
surprisingly
stage.
Little. Earle was here in the late 1820s, and by that stage there'd been at least two decades of quite intensive farming in the area by hapū, by the way. They were the ones doing the farming, not the settlers, by and large. And there was industrial-scale production of food, particularly pork and potatoes. So a lot of the land had been cleared, a lot of it had been burnt off. And in that particular painting, there's a lot of symbolism involved. So you'll see there's a pōwhenua there, and which, of course, is used to mark out territory and to denote where boundaries are and so on. And Earle pictures himself basically in this point with no regard to it. It's symbolising how Europeans now are transgressing all those old rules, all those old boundaries. They'd simply walk where they choose. And it's a spectator shot. He's encouraging the viewer to look out at that view of the Bay of Islands, and it looks available. And if you're in a very cramped, miserable terrace house in an industrial city in Britain, choking with smog and working miserable hours and it's cold and damp, it's a very inviting painting. You think, well, you know what? I could go there. I could start a new life. The grass looks greener in a way that people look at Australia now, I suppose. So, people from New Zealand think, well, opportunities are better in Australia, we'll go there. In the 19th century, people in Britain thought opportunities are better in New Zealand, and these sorts of paintings encourage them to see it that way.
Yeah, that's the beauty of a book like this, Paul, and I think you've done a remarkable job. And in your choice of images, I learnt a great deal. I don't think I know everything by any, you know, stretch of the imagination, but it certainly pulled me in and informed me of a lot more points of view than I'd imagined. So thank you for all the work you've done on this book, and I can thoroughly recommend it to those who are keen to expand their knowledge and do it by way of art history.
Thank you very much.
The book is called The Art of Colonisation, Images of Europe's Encounters with New Zealand. It's written by Professor Paul Moon and it's published by Ugly Hill Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Stephanie Holmes has written and published 55 books, completing in self-publishing self-described smutty paranormal romance novels at the rate of 3 or so a year. I'm not quite sure about that, maybe more. She lives well off the proceeds and largely off the grid with her husband James, 4 cats, some sheep, and presumably endless pukeko on a piece of rolling countryside somewhere in Kaipara. Steph is legally blind, with a kind of goth fashion aesthetic when she isn't in leggings and wellies, although even the leggings are likely to be batty. She joins me by Zoom to discuss novel 55, A Grave Mistake. Kia ora, Steph. Thanks for coming on the show.
Kia ora. Thanks for having me. And that was an awesome introduction.
Is Steph okay? I didn't check that out before we started.
No, Steph is totally fine.
Cool. That is quite the rate of output, Steph. Oh, my goodness. You describe the writing process, that, you know, the getting the words out process is great fun, but you seem to have a lot of fun with the whole process. Can you please tell our listeners about your book launch party for Grave Mistake?
Oh, we had the best time. So A Grave Mistake is my new book that's come out, and it's my second book ever with a traditional publisher. All my previous books had been indie published.
Right.
And the book is about these two vampires who fell in love back in sort of 1870s Paris. And she ran a vampire cabaret, which was a little bit like the, if you cross the Moulin Rouge with the Grand Guggenheim. So it was like a little bit bloody and gory and wonderful. And so I thought, because we've got all these scenes which are set back in the 1780s, and then the rest of the book is set in the present day after they meet again, I thought what would be really fun to kind of take those, you basically try and recreate a bit of a Paris cabaret kind of vampire kind of feel at the events that we did. So we had some posters made up as if it was the cabaret, which was called La Petite Morte. And we had them done up in the style of Toulouse-Lautrec, who did a lot of the old cabaret posters. And then I got a bunch of amazing performers and friends who are in the pole dancing and burlesque and drag scene to come along and perform. And we did two events with them, one up in Auckland at Enamored Books and one down in Wellington at a pole studio, but hosted by the Grimoire. And they were just so much fun. We had, you know, we had all these incredible performers, you know, like kind of doing vampire performances. And one of them Sabine, she was reading the kind of spicy passages of my book out loud, and then as she was doing that, she's kind of losing her clothes and getting a bit more uninhibited on the pole. It was great. It was so much fun.
Oh my goodness! Look. I'm not sure I'm brave enough for an invite to your next book launch, but that does sound like heaps of fun and so much to talk about. So you deliberately challenge a few norms. Now, I'm not just talking the paranormal stuff, but that genre gives you the freedom to challenge some norms about traditional romance novels. And can you tell us about, you know, that challenging, what it means to you kind of to break some of the rules and, yeah, why it's important to you?
So I think I've always been attracted to kind of stories with like a gothic element or a paranormal element, particularly because like a lot of that genre is about subverting rules and kind of holding up a twisted mirror to society, which I think is what kind of draws me to it. And so I was always going to be writing books with magic and vampires and things like that in them. I'm just pretty much incapable of kind of following rules. Like I think I just kind of like to do what I want. And I've been really lucky in that there is a cross section of the things that I enjoy writing about and the themes that I enjoy exploring and the kinds of characters that I enjoy writing and the kinds of things that people actually enjoy reading. My probably best selling series is the Nevermore Bookshop series, which is still indie published, and it's set in the same world as my new series, which is TradPub. And that series is about a heroine, and she is going blind progressively throughout the course of the series. And she gets fired from her dream job because she is going blind, and she ends up working in this magical bookshop, and the bookshop brings infamous fictional villains from classic literature to life. And she ends up kind of embroiled in these little cozy supernatural mysteries in her village, but also has a romance with three of the villains. Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights, Moriarty from Sherlock Holmes, a very young, very suave Moriarty from Sherlock Holmes, and a shape-shifting raven named Quoth from Edgar Allan Poe.
Wow, she's busy.
Yeah, she is busy. And, you know, when I started writing that series, the whole thing that I wanted to do was, I have read a lot of characters who are blind in other fantasy books and romance books, and there's often a thing where they, in order for the character to have a happily ever after, they have to be healed. And this is very common, especially in fantasy kind of settings where there's magic floating around. So you automatically assume, okay, well, there's magic floating around, so the character gets healed, they can see again, or they can they have like a magical power where they can like see through the eyes of animals or something like that. That's really common. And I wanted to not do that at all. I wanted to have a story where the heroine is blind and she gets to live this like wonderful, fantastic life and have all of the romance and all of the adventures, because that is what because that's what you can have in real life. Having a disability is not something that you have to endure until there's some kind of magic comes along and heals you. Basically show that in a series.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Because one of my questions here is, about, I watched that video about you that's linked off the RNZ website. Anybody, if you want to know Steph, as well as listening, go and have a look at that. It's very cool. And I think we can all agree that Steph Holmes is living her best life. And I just wanted to ask, was that a poll I spied in your study? I think it was. So is that just for research, or is poll a big part of your life, like your heroine Arabella in the Grave Mistake series?
No, I actually started poll in the middle of the COVID lockdown. Right. Just after the Auckland lockdown lifted, I sort of thought, well, it was something I'd always interested in trying. But it was just logistically, it was a bit difficult. But then I thought, well, do you know what? Like, if the world ends, I should go and try these things that I've always wanted to do. So I went and found myself a teacher, and I started learning. And so I've been doing pole for about 5 years, just as, you know, kind of for fitness and for fun. And it's been amazing. It's been such a journey. And I currently do what's called flying pole, which is more of an sort of aerial kind of circusy art. And that's where you have a pole and it's attached to the ceiling on a swivel, but it's not attached anywhere else. So you're spinning, the pole's spinning.
Oh my goodness.
It's wild and I love it.
Oh my goodness, because there's a flavour of women's friendship in the book that reminds me very much of the mad, enthusiastic kind of loving support that I've seen in snatches from my niece's pole dancing gal pack. Okay, so she's got this bunch of friends. She's a very good pole dancer and she's got this crazy energetic women's, and not only women's and quite queer, enthusiastic community around that. I wondered reading whether that community has been part of your cheer group too.
I think definitely, but when I kind of think about with this series, one of the things I wanted to do was create this real warm kind of group, just this warm, feral female friendship sort of group. That's actually largely inspired from the heavy metal community.
Oh, cool!
which doesn't come across in the books at all, really. But, you know, that's kind of where, that's the community where I found, as an adult, I found all my friendships have had a lot of incredible adventures. And so there's, you know, there's definitely a bit of that. But any kind of close community where especially where a lot of women gather and feel and like bond over, you know, a joint fandom or a joint activity that they really love, I think there's something so special about that, and I really wanted to capture that vibe.
Yeah, no, you definitely have captured that vibe. And you know, I wondered if in fact there's a similar community around, among romanticy or romantic-y, as you've coined the phrase romantic-y, which is kind of cross genres, which I loved. Is there a similar community like that that's supportive among romantic-y writers?
Very much so, and the readers as well. It's been so interesting to see this this whole new group of readers come up through things like Book Talk and you know, the romanticy genre in particular, and kind of come into reading and sort of make the community their own. And you know, there's all these incredible events that they go to and put on. And, you know, being able to be a part of that as an author and also to kind of meet and, you know, kind of be in community with other authors in the same space is very cool, especially because it's got a very similar sort of like niche feeling that I'm used to in other like kind of alternative communities. Because in a lot of ways, romance is still very kind of maligned by the kind of literature mainstream, even though it's the highest earning genre in fiction. And so there can be a little bit of a, you know, well, you guys don't like us, so we're just going to be over here having fun and we don't care what you think kind of vibe. And I kind of like that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it has such a large readership. The books are selling, as you point out, at a rate that you couldn't find in the your science fiction or a slightly more mainstream genre. And yet it's weird to call it mainstream. If it's kind of a lot smaller and tighter and more elite, is it mainstream, or is what you're doing appealing to a more mainstream audience?
Yes.
So it's kind of an intriguing concept. The idea of the Nevermore Murder Club and Smutty Book Coven, which is kind of this other series of yours, Arabella's set in the same world, but it's so playful. Both concepts are so playful. And that's one of the things that I noticed, even with the title, A Grave Mistake. Your writing is very playful. Personally, I don't look for romantic-y books. In my reading time, I want to soak up some other stuff, so that's just a choice. But I really enjoyed this read. And so this is just commenting on that kind of mainstream elitism thing. What I really enjoyed most was how the self-aware lightheartedness, even silliness of some of the wordplay and characterization, it's really fun. And it made me wonder, who is it? Who are you writing for? What, if you were to describe your specific audience persona, who do you think it is?
Oh, that's so interesting. So I think that a lot of what I am trying to do with these books, with everything in the Nevermore bookshop world, which encompasses three series now and probably more in the future, is to bring in, so basically the answer is people who are a bit like me, is the short answer. But there's probably
quite a small tight group, though, whereas you've got a whole lot of readers out there who are loving this.
Well, I wanted to kind of take sort of very cozy elements. I often describe the series as kind of Midsummer Murders, but with vampires. Midsummer Murders if it was a bit smuttier and it had vampires.
Yeah, sex and vampires, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and because I wanted to, I love that.
Quite hot sex, readers, just saying, quite hot sex.
Yes. So I wanted to kind of take that sort of small village, you know everyone, a little bit kind of Gilmore Girls-y humour, bringing in a lot of kind of pop culture references and things like that. That sort of feels like a warm hug of a book. And while also exploring the sort of vampire mythology, and the cool thing about writing vampires is that you can dig into, they're all quite old in some way, so you have to dig into various periods in history. And I used to be an archaeologist, so that's really appealing to me. And then also a little bit, also just you get to fall in love again every single book. So I think I'm sort of, a lot of the romance that's coming out and that's quite popular at the moment tends quite dark. And that happens often when there are kind of crazy things happening in the world, and readers in this genre often sort of gravitate to darker things during those periods. And I like being able to be the sort of the palate cleanser between big epic battles against good and evil. And you can just come over to Nevermore Bookshop and it just feels familiar and it feels cozy and it's a little bit of fun and you laugh and you cry. But it's not, it's not like world shifting.
No, sure.
Thanks. Yeah.
Sure. But I don't think, I would hate to trivialize it relative to other things in the genre, because it certainly it has a lot of appeal, and I guess all fiction is dealing with those themes, finding a thrilling and sustainable love, the goodness of friendships and loving relationships triumphing over shitty times. You do it in a light way, but you do it in a very enjoyable way for your readers, and I think it's worth celebrating that. we're going to run out of time, and so I need to bring this to a close. But thanks so much for joining us, Steph. The book is called A Grave Mistake. It's written and by Steph Holmes. And Steph, just remind me, your publisher then, I was going to say this is self-published, but you've got a, this isn't.
Correct, yes. So I, this is, book is published by Atria Australia, which is a new imprint of Simon & Schuster.
Cool.
And yeah, they have
Simon & Schuster following the money, are they, towards this?
Yeah, very good.
Okay, so Atria Australia is the publisher imprint of Simon & Schuster. It's available on the very pretty romantic-y bookshelves of any bookseller near you. Thank you very much for your time, Steph.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.